So without further ado, let's begin. We are still in the beginning. And this particular story that we're going to tell a series of stories, basically. This particular week's story is called, literally translated, the bringings forth of skies and the land. The bringings forth. Now, you say that's not even a word in English. It is an attempt to bring into English what the Hebrew says, and we're going to talk about that today. Before I get started in the actual class, I wanted to bring up a couple of points relative to our journey through the Torah according to this ancient cycle. You know, I believe that anything that God puts together, He does so in order. There is always an order whenever we're talking about things of heaven, an ordering. All divine work must be based upon order. We talk about separation. According to this ancient cycle of readings, they are broken down. The text itself is broken down into what we would call a seder. They're a series of seders. Now, you know, some of you might know that word. The root idea of seder is order, okay? And so this ancient series of divisions is very important, and I wanted to stress that. This particular book is called, I don't recommend this book, by the way, unless you really, really get into this stuff, like in a deep, deep way, and you're fairly good at Hebrew, but it's called The Introduction to the Masoretico-Critical Edition of the Hebrew Bible. Wow, what a title. So you know of this group called the Masoretes. The Masoretes were a group of scribes, and they handed down traditional pointing and so forth, elements about the text. The scribes recorded notes and so forth. And so in this particular book, this author, Ginsberg, one of the great Hebraists of all time, I guess you could say, wrote this book in an attempt to sort of introduce what he was putting together would be the master of all editions of the Hebrew Bible with all the critical apparatus and all the notes and so forth. And in the section called Sederim, we're talking about these ancient triennial cycle readings. You're going to hear me talk about white spaces and rightly dividing the word of truth. So these seders, these Sederim, represent the most ancient division. So here is a quote. He's quoting an ancient source, and he says, there are places where they read through the Torah in 3 years. Hence, the Pentateuch, which are the five books of Moses, is divided into, now in this particular quote, says 154 sections called Sederim. So that one Seder is read on each Sabbath, accordingly the Torah is finished at the end of every 3 years. Now, I told you last week that most traditional Jewish congregations work through the Torah according to the annual cycle of readings. This particular study that we are embarking upon is going to take us through the same material, but it's going to allow us to really get down into the text, which is what I hope to do in my teaching. You know, I've been praying about this, and I really want to dig deeply each and every week. Now, there's one other thing that I would like to tell you about, and it comes from this particular book. In 1524, 1525, a Jewish scholar by the name of Yaakov ben Chaim put together the first edition of the Hebrew Bible according to the Masorah, according to these traditional divisions and Masoretic notes and so forth. And the quote says this, Jacob ben Chaim, the first editor of the Bible with the Masorah, assures us in his elaborate introduction that if he had found this Masoretic division, talking about what we're going through, if he had found this Masoretic division of the text, he would have followed it in preference to the Christian chapters, which he adopted from Rabbi Nathan's Hebrew Concordance. Having, however, obtained the list when he had nearly carried the Bible through the press, he says, quote, I have published it separately so that it may not be lost in Israel. Now think about that. What Jacob ben Chaim wanted to get across is that during the process of publishing this first rabbinic Bible, we would say, with all the critical notes and everything he could find according to the Masorah, he's working on it. It's close to finished production, and he discovers that there's this ancient set of divisions. Now, the chapters that we currently have come from, in many ways, the Christian Bible. So, anciently, I think most people know this, the Bible didn't, you didn't say in an ancient synagogue, open your Bibles, please, to the book of Genesis. The book of Genesis, chapter 2, beginning in verse 4. They didn't have that. They would refer to these ancient stories by the heading. Guess what this one's called? The bringings forth of skies and the land. The bringings forth of the skies and the land. So I wanted to stress to you that I didn't just arbitrarily decide to change and go against the grain and teach according to a cycle that no one else that I know of is going according to. There probably are other groups that are working through this. But what I did was I began to truly feel a desire to be in step with the most ancient cycle of divisions, and I wanted to take us on a deeper journey into the text of the Bible. So I decided to follow this ancient cycle of readings, and you can see from this comment that I just read that one of the purposes, and I need you to understand this, because whatever people might think about me for saying it, I believe that there is a group that is currently awakening from a slumber. I believe that this group that I would call Ephraim or Joseph, the lost sheep of the house of Israel, are beginning to search out and truly desire to understand the Torah. So when Jacob ben Chaim says, I published it separated or separate so that it wouldn't be lost to Israel, I don't want it to be lost to Israel. In fact, I want Israel to truly, truly understand the Bible, and that's why we're doing what we're doing. I want to start this morning with a passage that I read last week to stress the importance of Torah study. Now, as I told you, I often will say this out loud, but whether I say it out loud or not, anytime I study, anytime I teach, especially when I'm teaching from the Torah, I quote Psalm 119:18, which says in Hebrew, Gal einai v'avita nifla'ut mitorah tekai. Reveal, open my eyes, and I will look for wonderful things in your Torah. Now, why the Torah? Why are we focused on the Torah? In Deuteronomy chapter 31, beginning in verse 10, it says, And Moses commanded them, saying, At the end of every 7 years, in the time of the year of release, in the feast of booths, when all Israel is to come to appear before Jehovah your God, in the place which he shall choose, you shall read this Torah before all Israel in their hearing. Listen, there is something about reading the Torah aloud. It's to all Israel. You'll remember in Malachi chapter 3, verse 22, chapter 4, verse 4 in an English Bible, it says, Remember the Torah of Moses, which he commanded all Israel at Horeb, statutes and judgments. So I pick back up in verse 12 of Deuteronomy 31. Gather the people together. And this is the reason you do this. Men, women, children, your stranger that is within your gates, that they may hear, that they may learn and fear Jehovah your God and guard to do all the words of this Torah, and that their children who've not known anything may hear and learn to fear Jehovah your God as long as you live in the land, whether you go over the Jordan to possess it. And I'm here to tell you that even though the children of Israel are currently scattered throughout all nations, there is still a relevance to hearing the words. Because remember, in Ezekiel 37, Ezekiel sees a valley of dry bones. And he's told that this valley of dry bones represents the entire house of Israel, Judah and Israel. And they're very, very dry. I just love this passage. So you're going to hear it maybe every Saturday or every time I speak because it's so important. He says, will the bones live? Can these bones live? And he said, yes. He said, you know, my Lord. And he tells him, prophesy to the bones. And what does he say? Hear the word of Jehovah. Now, I believe that in our day, there's a famine. I talked about this last week. But as this word goes forth, I believe that the bones, you'll see a rattling and a shaking in the spirit, if you will. But these bones are coming together. Some of you are gathered together on this Shabbat. This is the purpose. There is a reason that we do what we do. Now, there's something else that I want to confess in a way. Over the years, I've known about a pattern that is talked about in Scripture, or that's demonstrated in Scripture. There's only one passage that I can think of which describes what I think should take place on Saturday mornings, or any time the people come together for the purpose of receiving the Word. Now, it comes to us from the book of Nehemiah, chapter 8. And when the people were returning from the captivity, talks in this particular chapter about Ezra going up before the people, and he read from the Torah, and then he explained it. Now, for years now, I've taught my class, and then I read the Torah, and then we discussed it. Not saying that's wrong, but I'm saying it doesn't go with the pattern. Now, I believe in patterns. In Exodus, I believe it's 8 or 9 times, God tells Moses, be sure to do this according to the pattern. In Hebrew, it's tavnit. And tavnit is associated with the Hebrew word bana, to build. So if you're talking about a pattern and you're wanting to build something, anything, you need a pattern to do it right. And so I pray about this. And you know, in the psalm it says that unless Jehovah build the house, they that labor, labor in vain. So understand my thinking here. I want to go back and say, if I'm trying to help build something, if I'm trying to bring an awareness to a group, and I'm trying to teach people the truths of the Bible, then I ought to follow the pattern. So, having said all that, I'm going to begin this Saturday to follow that pattern that is laid forth in the book of Nehemiah. What that means is I'm going to begin right now. I'm going to read the section of Scripture, and then I'm going to talk about it. I'm going to teach about it. I'm going to go into the text and explain it. Then, after that, we'll go to the table, we'll discuss, and we'll entertain questions from our internet congregation. So, here we go. Those of you who are not currently members of our Facebook group, United Israel, you can find us on Facebook as a group. It's an open group. You just simply have to request to join, and I will quickly accept that. So we post every week the section of Scripture that we're going to be working through. So that particular section that I'm going to read from is already posted. I'm reading today, and my intention is to work through the Torah using the translation by Dr. James Tabor. It's called the Transparent English Bible. We talked about it last week. So we're going to begin today in Genesis chapter 2, verse 4. Chapter 2, verse 4 of Genesis, Bereshit. And it says, these are the bringings forth of the skies and the land in their being created. In the day of the making of Jehovah Elohim, land and skies, and no shrub of the field was before that on the land, and no plant of the field had before that sprouted, for Jehovah Elohim had not made rain on the land, and there was no soil creature to service the soil. And a flow would go up from the land, and it made drink all the face of the soil. And Jehovah Elohim shaped the soil creature, dust from the soil. And he blew into his nostrils the breath of life, and the soil creature became a living life breather. And Jehovah Elohim planted a garden in Eden at the east. There he placed the soil creature whom he shaped. Jehovah Elohim made sprout from the soil every tree desired for sight and good for an eatable thing, and the tree of life in the middle of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and bad. And a river goes out from Eden to make drink the garden, and from there it is separated, and it becomes four heads. The name of the first is Pishon. It goes around all the land of Havilah, where there is gold. The gold of that land is good. There are bdellium and the onyx stone. The name of the second river is Gihon. It goes around all the land of Cush. The land of the third river is Hiddekel. It is the one walking east of Assyria. The fourth river, it's Euphrates. Jehovah Elohim took the soil creature, made him rest in the Garden of Eden to service it and to guard it. Jehovah Elohim laid charge upon the soil creature, saying, "From every tree of the garden, eating you will surely eat. And from the tree of the knowledge of good and bad, you will not eat from it. For on the day you eat from it, dying, you will surely die." And Jehovah Elohim said, "Not good, the soil creature being by himself. I will make for him a help as his one before." And Jehovah Elohim shaped from the soil every living thing of the field and every flyer of the skies, and he made come toward the soil creature to see what he would call to it. And whatsoever the soil creature would call to it, each living life breather, that was its name. And the soil creature called names to every animal and to the flyer of the skies and to every living thing of the field, and to soil creature he did not find a help as his one before. And Jehovah Elohim made a deep sleep fall upon the soil creature, and he slept. And he took one from his sides, and he closed flesh under it. And Jehovah Elohim built the side that he took from the soil creature into a woman, and he made her come toward the soil creature. The soil creature said, "This one, this, bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh, to this one will be called woman, because from a man this one was taken. Therefore a man will leave his father and his mother and join with his woman, and they become one flesh." And the two of them were nude, the soil creature and his woman, and they were not ashamed. And the Nakash was shrewd from every living thing of the field that Jehovah Elohim made. And he said toward the woman, "Did Elohim indeed say, 'You may not eat from any tree of the garden?'" And the woman said toward the Nakash, "From the fruit of the trees of the garden we may eat, and from the fruit of the tree that is in the middle of the garden, Elohim said, 'You will not eat from it, and you will not touch it, lest you die.'" The Nakash said toward the woman, "Dying you will not surely die, for Elohim knows that in the day that you eat from it, that your eyes will be opened, and you will be as Elohim, knowing good and bad." And the woman saw that the tree was good for an eatable thing, and that it was a longing to the eyes, and the tree was desirable for causing insight. She took from its fruit, and she ate, and she gave also to her man with her, and he ate. And the eyes of the two of them were opened, and they knew that they were nude, and they sewed leaves of the fig tree, and they made for themselves loincloths, and they heard the voice of Jehovah Elohim walking about in the garden in the wind of the day. And the soil creature made himself hidden, and his woman, from the face of Jehovah Elohim in the middle of the trees of the garden. And Jehovah Elohim called toward the soil creature and said to him, "Where are you?" And he said, "Your voice I heard in the garden, and I feared, for I was nude and I was hidden." And he said, "Who told you that you were nude? From the tree that I charged you so as not to eat from it, have you eaten?" And the soil creature said, "The woman that you gave her to be with me, she gave to me from the tree, and I ate." And Jehovah Elohim said to the woman, "What is this that you've done?" The woman said, "The Nakash, he deceived me, and I ate." Jehovah Elohim said toward the Nakash, "Because you've done this, cursed are you above every animal and above every living thing of the field. Upon your belly you will walk, and dust you will eat all the days of your life. And hostility I will set between you and between the woman, and between your seed and between her seed. He will strike you on the head, and you will strike him on the heel." Toward the woman he said, "Making abundant, I will surely make abundant. your distress and your pregnancy. In distress you will bring forth sons, and toward your man will be your craving, and he will rule in you. And it, to soil creature he said, because you hearkened to the voice of your woman, and you ate from the tree that I charged you, saying you will not eat from it, cursed is the soil on account of you. In distress you will eat it all the days of your life, and thorn and thistle it will sprout for you. You will eat the plant of the field. In the sweat of your two nostrils you will eat bread until you return to the soil, for from it you were taken, for dust you are, and toward dust you will return. The soil creature called the name of his woman Eve, for she was the mother of all living. And Jehovah Elohim made for the soil creature and his woman robes of skin, and he dressed them. Now, I love this translation because it's very literal. It's very, very literal. And you will see, to some, it even seems a bit rustic. I don't know how you would describe it. It's very, very literal. So what you get is, you get so much of what the Hebrew is actually conveying in English. So what most translators do is they change things to fit more our common vernacular, the way that we speak. For instance, you heard me say, you heard me read that this river walked. Now, most people would change that. Most translators would say that the river goes this way or whatever. But the idea is that it's very literal. So if the word there is halak, which is the Hebrew word behind the English, which it means to walk. So we put that in the translation so that you get the feel, the rhythm, the puns, the alliterations. As often as you can, you'll see this in the English translation of the Transparent English Bible. Today, I want to talk to you about creation. I want to talk to you about two particular views. We had last week what I would say is a cosmic view in chapter 1, whereas in this week, we have the view from the ground up. So you have a heaven down and an earth up. That's what we see in chapters 1 and chapters 2. This particular reading is introduced by the Hebrew Toledot. Toledot. Now, in the opening passage that we are reading from today, in Genesis 2, verse 4, just so you hear it in the Hebrew, it says, Eli toledot ha-shemayim v'ha'aretz b'hibaram. B'yom asot Yehovah Elohim eretz v'shemayim. Now, this particular word that I want to focus on first, toledot, it's tied to the root yalad. Now, a yelid is, you might recognize this word, it's the word for a boy. Yalda is the feminine. Yalad means to bring forth, to birth. All right? So what we're talking about here is birthing, but notice that it's described in the plural. So it opens up, it's talking about these are the birthings. The birthings. Now, this particular phrase, Eli toldot, is used 10 times in Genesis. And each time it introduces, you're going to see these as we work through the Torah portions, especially in Genesis, you're going to see these 10 separations. These are the generations. These are the generations of Adam. These are the generations, so forth and so on. But this particular phrase begins our Torah reading today after the major break at 2:3, so chapter 2, verse 4 begins, Ele toldot. Now, we're talking about plural, the birthings. So I'm going to talk to you today about two views of creation. And the way I've got these in my mind is the first one that we went through last week, I would call born from above. Born from above. It's the cosmic view. So work with me on this. Stay with me. This is just the way it came to me last night when I was studying. today's class, I want to talk about the birth from the earth. So we have the birthings, toledot. Last week, born from above. This week, birth from the earth. Now, I just want to let you know that most scholars consider these two separate accounts as coming from different hands. They believe that these are so different that they weren't from the same author. What I'm talking about today says that that's not essential to even get into, because I think we can see as we work through this that there is enough congruence, there's enough similarity that both could come from the same author, but they both, whether you believe one way or the other, they both tell an interesting part of the story. It's essential to understand both of these. So traditionally, the story of creation in Genesis 1, the story of creation in Genesis 2, traditionally are the same story. It's just simply a retelling or two tellings of the same tale. Two tellings, T-E-L-L, of the same tell, T-A-L-E. So, but they're representing the same events. It's all about perspective. So these are represented by the careful wording found in chapter 2, verse 4. Once again, in English, let me open that up because it's a very important part of our class today. It says, these are the bringings forth of the skies and the land. In their being created, in the day of the making of Jehovah Elohim, land and skies. Now, Dave, work with me on the video here. Let me get my marker. I'm going to use black because last week I heard that all my beautiful colors didn't really matter because you couldn't see them. All right. So notice we're talking about bringings. Learned a new English word today. Bringings forth. All right. Here's what we're talking about. Notice that it says, in the day of the making of Jehovah Elohim, land and skies. Let me add an E there. Skies. And then notice, These are the bringings forth of the skies and land, right? In their being created, in the day of the making of Jehovah Elohim, land and skies. So notice the order. You have skies and land, and then you have land and skies. So you have two. We're talking about plural, the bringings forth. Now, You might think I'm making a little bit more out of this. In the beginning, in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, it says, Bereshit bara, in beginning, or at the first, he created, what does it say? The heavens are the skies and the land. All right, so this passage, now that we're moving into the second section, we're talking about birthings, we're talking about skies and land. Oh, and by the way, land and skies. What I want to talk to you about, you got to get this, is that we're talking about perspective. We're looking at it from different angles, if you will, different vantage points. The cosmic view, born from above, the earthly view, the birth from the earth. Now, you'll notice this week it's something a little bit different. We start noticing differences. For instance, in the first section of text, I told you last week that in the first reading, the creation account uses the generic title Elohim. It doesn't use the divine name. Whereas in this particular reading, in chapter 2, we begin in chapter 2, verse 4, when it's talking about the same creation from a different vantage point, it uses the divine name, and it's Yehovah, right? I pronounce the name. And I know that there are differences of opinion on that. Look, I don't do that out of disrespect. I have much, much respect for the divine name. I do it more to eliminate confusion, because when someone reads Lord it becomes quite confusing. What Lord are you talking about? In Hebrew, it's very specific. We're talking about four letters in Hebrew. We're talking about Yod, He, Vav, He. All right? These four letters in Hebrew occur together in the text nearly 7,000 times. This is the divine name. All right? This is not a generic title. Now, the thing about it is, it's called the Tetragrammaton. You might notice the word tetra, which means four, grammaton, letters, the four letters. But anyway, Yod He Vav He, this name occurs for the first time in this particular reading. I'm not trying to be controversial when I teach and use the name. The point is that we're talking not generic. We're not talking about some title. We're talking specifically and calling the Creator by name, which, by the way, all ancients did. There was no ban on the name in the days of Moses. Moses clearly referred to God by name, as did David and all the prophets and so forth and so on. It was very commonly used in ancient Israel, and I believe it will be again. We'll teach that in another day. So, in this particular creation, I want to tell you that in this account, we find points of congruence with the first account. I don't see it as so different than the account in Genesis chapter 1 when you look at it and you understand that we're talking about perspective. So, for instance, you'll recall last week that it describes the chaotic scene at the first. It describes what would be this beautiful blue dot, as it's referred to now by some scientists. It's referred to as tohu vohu. It's desolate and waste. The idea is that it's uninhabitable. There is a darkness. There is, at the time when the creation, right before the creation begins, there was no separation between the light and between the dark. There was no separation. There was no expanse between the waters which were above the expanse, and there was no separation between that and the waters which were below. And then he causes the land to appear. Now, in the second Seder that we begin working through today that we just read from, it somewhat glosses over that particular vantage point and quickly gets us to the land. We quickly, in this week, because why? Because we're going land and skies. See, last week was skies and land. But notice it goes quickly through that, and it starts us off, but it does touch on this desolate idea. Now, how does it do that? Listen to this. It says there was no shrub. There was no shrub on the land. No plant of the field had yet sprouted. Right? See, it's this idea that it's not this lush vegetative state. I mean, there's nothing. It's just, and it says further, no plant of the field had sprouted. This was before there had been caused to rain. There's no rain. And before man. Now, remember in last week, we had the creation of man. You see, so what I'm telling you is that this is another vantage point we're going to get deeper into from the earth up, and we're going to look at the creation of man. So this then becomes the focus, the creation of Adam. Now, I want to make a point. The creation of Adam is to meet a need, to meet a need. Today, I want you to understand something. If we were to look biblically at the question, what is the purpose of man? Now, I've heard people say, and it might sound wonderful, and it might sound a great thing to say in religious circles, that man is created, that God created man to worship Him. Meaning, worship in their mind when they say this means something different than it does Hebraically anyway. But what does the Bible say about why man is created? All right, we're going to talk about that. What is the purpose of man? Why is he created? In Hebrew, it's expressed like this. Let me look at Genesis chapter 2, verse 5. Genesis chapter 2, verse 5. Let's see. It says, V'adam ein la'avod et ha'adama. And a man there was not to service the ground. Now, Adam and Adama are clearly related in the text, so it's tough to translate, and even tougher if you're trying to bring across and retain a connection. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to show you in English. We have come to think of Adam as the guy's name. You have Adam and you have Eve. But notice in Hebrew, this is called transliterate. To transliterate means to take a word that's in Hebrew and bring that into another language using the letters of that language. So how do you bring across the closeness or the connection between the words? You have Adam. Where does he come from? The Adama. Where the difference is, see, they're related, right? So whatever Adam is, whatever Adam is, it's related to the Adama. We're going to talk about that. We're going to look at that today. So I want to go back to the need, though. For what purpose is Adam created? Now, go back with me to Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. And I'm going to read from... I've got to get a little bit better organized before next week. I don't think I have any babies being born or surgeries or anything like that. Chapter 1, verse 26. Says this, and Elohim said, let us make a soil creature, Adam, in our image, according to our likeness, and let them govern in fish of the sea, with the flyers of the skies, and in the animals, and in all the land, and in every moving thing that moves about upon the land. And Elohim created the soil creature in his image, in the image of Elohim he created him, male and female, he created him. So if we read Genesis 1, the cosmic account, the born from above account, what do we learn about the purpose of man? Why is he created? It says that he is created for the purpose of governing. This is the translation that James used in this particular passage. The image is a bit misunderstood, I think. Now, when we go into chapter 2, what we read is that he is created because there was a need. There was no one to service or serve. The word there, the root word is avad, to serve, to work. There's no one to service the soil. So I want to make a connection here. I take the word translated as govern in various other ways and other translations as to care for, to oversee, perhaps even to have responsibility for. See, a lot of times people get in their image that Adam is created as a ruler, like he is to rule over. And that creates, it conjures up, it brings up certain images in our mind that is, I think, not what was intended. If you think of one who is to govern, one who is to care for and oversee, that to me ties more closely into the idea of Genesis chapter 2. Different Hebrew words, I'm just trying to connect the essential meanings here. In Genesis chapter 2, we have the idea of service. Now, question becomes, how does one govern, care for, oversee, or even have or take responsibility. I think that is through service. See, the point being that when you notice that there's a need, there's no one to service. When you don't have a servant, someone who's willing to serve and care for, there's a need. That's the idea. We're talking about creation. We're talking about building from the earth up. We're talking about, I'm giving you a pattern today. I'm beginning to pull from the text certain key points that will build one upon the other. At the end of my lesson today, I'll pull it all together. So don't worry if you're not connecting the dots yet. A picture begins to emerge for me concerning Adam. He's the highest of the creation. The crowning achievement of all that God sets forth to do and to make. This Adam is the only part of creation that is described as being in the image and likeness of the Creator. Think about that. Over the next few weeks, I already know, you know where we're going in some ways, but I already know what some people's view of humanity is. I already know what some people think of man. But right now, I want you to stay with me. God created Adam. Elohim created Adam in His image and in His likeness. There was a need to care for, to oversee, to have responsibility, to serve. So in that first reading, in Genesis 1, 26 and 27, it says, "Let us make," asah, to do or to make, "in the image and likeness." And then verse 27, it says, "Elohim created bara," the Adam, ha Adam. It's not a name. All right? So just so you know, this in context is not always the name. Like a lot of people, it's a popular name. People name their sons Adam. Like that's the first man, Adam and Eve, his wife. By the way, wife's not used either, ever. Different class, though. Elohim created him. Male and female, He created them. Genesis chapter 1 is a sweeping review of the creation. Genesis 2, we zero in and we talk about the specifics of that creation. In the second reading, look at Genesis chapter 2, verse 7. It says, "And Yehovah Elohim shaped the soil creature, dust from the soil, and He blew into his nostrils breath of life. And the soil creature became a living life breather." All right. Now, I think I touched a little bit on this last week, but it's very important because there are so many false teachings out there. If I wanted to be kind and not say there are so many false teachings out there, how could I say this? There are a lot of teachings out there that aren't biblical. Yeah. There are concepts which are foreign to the Hebrew Bible. Now, one concept that I want to talk about is this idea of what is man? What is Adam? Now, here's what most people believe. That we, collectively and individually, are made up of three parts. Body plus spirit plus soul. You ever heard that? Mm-hmm. It's not true. It's not biblical. All right? Now, here's the idea. What comes out of that is people begin to think about each of these elements that they believe make up us. So what they begin to talk about, have you ever heard anybody talk about the immortality of the soul? Yeah. Immortality of the soul. Guess what? That's not biblical either. I'm going to show you that today. The Torah teaches and the Tanakh teaches something different than that. If you look at, let me open my Bible here. If you open up to Ecclesiastes, I just want to give you a passage to back up what I just said. You know, sometimes teachers will say something and then they don't back it up. So let's do this. Let's go to Ecclesiastes chapter 12. And let's see. Ecclesiastes chapter 12. And let's just read verse 7. It says, "And the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it." What I'm going to do is use this to set up my next point. All right. In the Hebrew Bible, we get the idea, you know, I just talked about the spirit returning and dust going to dust. That's from our Torah reading today. In Genesis chapter 3, verse 19, it says, "Dust you are, and to dust you shall return." The soul that sins, you need to have this in your notes, the soul that sins, it will, anybody know the last word?
Die.
The soul that sins, it will die. I'm going to read to you Ezekiel chapter 18. It's a little bit lengthy, but bear with me. It's important. Ezekiel chapter 18. People have a lot of false teachings. Ezekiel chapter 18, beginning in verse 1. "The word of Jehovah came to me again, saying, 'What mean you that you use this proverb concerning the land of Israel, saying, the fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge? As I live, says Jehovah Elohim, you shall not have occasion any more to use this proverb in Israel. Behold, all souls are mine. As the soul of the father, so also the soul of the son is mine. The soul that sins, it shall die.'" Now, I actually, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it talks about the various sins that will lead to death. But notice that phrase, "the soul that sins, it will die." In Hebrew, it says, "the soul that sins, it will die." All right? Now, that way you just know that I'm not just making that up in English. It's not a faulty translation. It's very clear. But the idea, the other idea that really stands out in this particular passage is there was this idea that one would sin and another would pay for it. And what Ezekiel 18 says and Ezekiel chapter 33 says basically the same in many other texts is each one is accountable for his own sin. He says, "No longer will you use this proverb, 'The fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge.' The soul that sins, it will die." All right, so I want you to understand that this is not body plus spirit plus soul, immortality of the soul, soul lives forever. Look, I have people talking about this idea of an animal-type soul, and you have to elevate yourself spiritually to get into another kind of soul, and there are all these different... Come on. Let's just talk about the Bible, okay? What we have is, according to the Bible, we have body, and then it says that God breathes into his nostrils breath of life, a ruach, spirit. And man becomes, as Tabor translates it, a living life breather. In Hebrew, it's nephesh, which is always translated soul. So here's what I mean. Body plus spirit plus breath plus this nishma, this breath. Body plus spirit equals a living soul. Now, what happens, this is like the triangle, the fire triangle. If you have this, this, and it. If you take out this, this dies. All right? You can you have a body without breath that's alive?
No.
So this is a very essential part of it, right? Ruach. Now, I know this is a Torah class, but this is a Spirit-filled Torah class. We want to talk about the Spirit. See, you can't... This is a Hebrew Bible thing. All right? Very, very important to get this. All right. So in chapter 2, you know, when we talk about all this, we get this image that takes away this idea that there is an immortal soul. See, the Hebrews believed in resurrection of the dead, not an immortality of the soul. Now, here's what happened. Immortality of the soul gets picked up by everybody. It's in Judaism. It's in Christianity. I mean, it's one of the tenets of the faith. We believe in the immortality of the soul. Everybody believes that. Everybody except the writer of Genesis, right, and Ecclesiastes. So we want to be biblical. I'm not making fun. I'm trying to stress the point that the essential teaching is let's get it right. Let's go on and think about this. I'm not trying to be critical. But this idea that there's some that you should be trying to get out of your animal soul and somehow connect with this other soul, it's just maybe someone can write me and show me those passages from the Bible. I just don't see them. Okay. By the way, in Genesis chapter 2, here's another teaching that I hear a lot of times. I have to dispel some things that aren't scriptural. Have you ever heard of people talk about the Yetzer Tov and the Yetzer Ra? It's the good inclination and the bad inclination. All right. And most, not most, some people teach that we are comprised of these two, like competing yin and yang, the good and the bad. And they get that because in Hebrew, in Genesis chapter 2, it's Vayitzer, and it has two yuds in it. It's like it's in Hebrew, you would expect that Vayitzer would only have one yud. So they said, Yetzer is the word for inclination. That's the way it's translated. So they say these two yuds in Vayitzer represent the Yetzer Tov and the Yetzer Ra, the good inclination, the bad inclination. In other words, the Bible doesn't say that. People say they impose these ideas on subtleties from the text. I hope I'm not getting in trouble here, actually. Actually, no. I want to get in trouble if it means straightening some things out. So I'd just say that we have to understand that we are a body with life breathing. We're a living soul. When we die, we become a dead soul. Or, you know, it's a dead nephesh. All right. So let's consider Adam. Adam is created in the image and likeness of Elohim. Male and female. Interesting. This first Adam is both male and female. Think about that. In one. All right. This is alluded to in the cosmic view in Genesis chapter 1, verse 26 and 27. And it's even talked about in Genesis 2. Same story, different perspective. So you have male and female. This being, Adam, is made from dust of the ground. Like it says in Genesis chapter 3, verse 19, dust you are, dust you are, dust you are, dust you are, dust you are. And to dust you'll return. Now, interesting, Ecclesiastes says the spirit returns to the one who made it, right? When the person dies, according to Ecclesiastes, the spirit goes back to the one that made it. Psalm 37. Into your hands I commit my spirit. Mm-hmm. See, they understood that. Hebrews understood this. It's like I'm alive, I'm a living breather, and when I die, my spirit goes back to the one that made it. It's his breath. See, people that aren't thankful for life, they miss this idea. You have God's breath. All right. They're created. Adam is created to govern, to service the soil. It says that this being, both male and female, Adam, is placed, literally it says rested, in the Garden of Eden, Gan Eden. Now, how many of you know what Eden means? Eden means paradise, if you will, delight. So what we have is we have an image where this particular being is formed, shaped in Genesis chapter 2, and placed, literally rested in this particular garden with the purpose of to serve and to protect, to serve and to guard, to serve and to keep. The idea is that this person, this being, is placed there not just to bask in the glory of walking in the presence of the Creator, but there is a job to do. There is a specific task which Adam is given and created for, and that is to serve and to guard the land. Now, in this particular garden, vegetation grows, it's full of trees, and Adam is given permission to eat, right? Diet is important in Scripture from the very beginning. And because of that, it opens up the whole question. Some of you may have heard this. Is the kingdom of God food and drink? I mean, is diet really important? And we're just talking about things that are in this first Torah portion. Very much important. From the very outset, what we have in Scripture is a stress on the importance of diet. If you look at Genesis chapter 1, verse 29, now the diet changes in Scripture, but notice how it begins. And Elohim said, "Look, I've given to you every plant seeding seed that is upon the face of all the land, and every tree in which there is fruit of a tree, seeding seed, to you it will be for an eatable thing. And to every living thing of the field, and to every flyer of the skies, and to every moving about thing on the land that is in it, living life breath, every green plant is for an eatable thing." And it was so. The idea is that humans and other creatures all had the same diet. Now, this is that cosmic view. Notice, at this point, there is no garden, right? That's in Genesis 2, because now we're moving in. Then it says he places in east, in the east, a garden in Eden. Now, there's a pattern that I don't want to get into yet, but I want to make a comparison later with this idea of Eden being in the east and the setup of the tabernacle and all that. If you think about it, there is this special carved out holy place. But I don't want to go into that today. But there is a connection. You have to think. Look, we are talking about a pattern. And the pattern is going to hold true from the very beginning in all these stories. There are going to be points of congruence, points where these things connect. All right. So if you look at, in this particular Torah portion, in Genesis, we're talking about diet right now. If you look at Genesis chapter 2, verse 8, Jehovah Elohim planted a garden in Eden at the east. So you have the land of Eden, and then there's a garden. Right? A Garden of Eden. And there he placed the soil creature whom he shaped. And Jehovah Elohim made sprout from the soil every tree desired for sight and good for an eatable thing, and the tree of life in the middle of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and bad. Now go down to verse 16. Chapter 2, Genesis, verse 16. And Jehovah Elohim laid charge upon the soil creature, saying, "From every tree of the garden, eating you will surely eat, and from the tree of the knowledge of good and bad you will not eat from it, for on the day you eat from it, dying, you will surely die." So he puts a charge, he creates this special place, he provides food for his people, and then he says, and this is really the only rule in the garden. You have what is permitted and what is forbidden. Now, people can debate why something is forbidden all day. It doesn't say other than it provides a consequence if you eat from the tree that's forbidden. So there are things that are permitted. There are things that are forbidden. We get that right away. Here's what we know. Taking part in forbidden things brings death. Mut tamut. Dying, you will die. The idea that the Hebrew Bible wants to put forth is the soul that sins, it will die. This isn't a class on sin. That comes in the next week or so. But the idea, though, is if you do that which is forbidden, it brings death. That's been told to us from the very beginning, right? Very important. It's important also to note that life is associated with obedience. Now, this is the pattern. It goes all the way through Scripture. And that's why it boggles my mind now that for so many years I bought into this idea that doing God's commandments brings death. I was taught that. And they might not have said it just well. I think they did say it just like that. The idea, though, is that's counter to the pattern. God says, do this and you'll live. Do this, you'll be blessed. Do this, you'll have this. Do this, which is forbidden, and you'll die. The soul that sins, it will die. For his own sins, by the way. The privilege, here's a point. The privilege of rest and even of service is connected with obedience. The privilege of rest and even of service is connected with obedience. Get this. Obey, you stay. Don't, and you won't. I wrote that in my notes last night just to kind of get the idea captured, and then it kind of started hitting me. We're talking about staying and dwelling in the presence and serving the Creator. How do you get in that place where you're dwelling in the presence and you're serving the Creator? You obey, you stay. You don't, you won't. It's that simple. It's very clear that we are trying to get in that place. That's what it requires. It requires something on our part. Now, when we talk about the story, whereas in the cosmic account, in reading, one only speaks of good. Remember in that cosmic view from that birth from above, if you will, that birthing of heavens and earth, the creation, it says this over and over, and it was good, and it was good, and it was good, and it was good. And then finally it says, Tov Ma'od, very good, exceedingly good. For the first time in the Hebrew Bible this week, only two chapters in, we find something not good. And I've stressed this for many years because I believe it's true. I think we see it in our society, in our culture. Being alone is not good. Now, there are times when I want to be by myself. Don't get me wrong. There are times when you'll want to be alone. But to be alone, like really alone, where you don't have that interactive, that connection, it's not good. It's not good. So what happens is, in Genesis chapter 2, verse 18, it says, and Jehovah Elohim said, not good, the soil creature being by himself. Now, the translation says, I will make for him a help as his one before. Martha asked this question. What does that mean? I saw it last night on our Facebook group. What we're trying to understand, what we're trying to bring across in the English here is a phrase in Hebrew that is Ezer Kenegdo. Ezer Kenegdo. This is transliterating. I'm bringing the Hebrew into English. Keneg. Let me add a vowel. Can I buy an E? Kenegdo. All right. The idea is, How do you say, so he says, Adam, it's not good for man to be alone. I'm going to make him an Ezer Kenegdo. Now, remember, he's talking about a being that is both male and female in the image of God, made from the dust. He's already had this, he's named all the animals, he's looked around, but there's nothing comparable. This Adam does not have, now Ezer in Hebrew, we'll go ahead and get into the meaning, Ezer is typically translated as help. I think the King James calls it a helpmeet, a helper, right? A helper. So there, he says, I'll make him a helper. Now the question becomes, what does that mean? What is kenegdo? Kenegdo, this particular part of the word, ka, means like or as. All right? Negdo, this idea is most literally translated opposite or in front of, right? So the idea that you get is you have someone who is opposing. Come, can you come up here, Sherry, just for a second, just to show? So this isn't a, it's not a confrontational opposite, but if you have, she's really Dave's Ezer Kenegdo, but just for illustration purposes. So you're like my helper, like my opposite. Mm-hmm. You're not opposing me. We're not like fighting, but it's a complementary. It's two working together. So the image, that's all I wanted you to see. It's someone as the one before. So in the translation where he says the one before, it doesn't mean like the one who came before, nothing like that.
That other woman
not that other one. Yes, not like the helper, like the one before, which some mystics get into that too. But that's, we're not doing that today. At least not on camera, right? But the idea is that this one like before, you know, if you said, hey, what's before you? You could say that even in our language today. Well, what's before me this week? Well, let's see. On Monday I have this, Tuesday I have this, or this is before me. It's in front of me. That's the idea. So what it's saying is that he wants to make a helper like the one before him, something complementary,
a better half.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's probably actually the best way to put it. And so then in Genesis chapter 2, look at verse 21. We're going to show how he pulls out this Ezer Kenegdo. All right. It says this in verse 21, chapter 2, verse 21, Yehovah Elohim made a deep sleep, a tardema, a deep sleep, to fall upon the soil creature, and he slept. And he took one from his sides, and he closed flesh under it. And Yehovah Elohim built the side that he took from the soil creature into a woman, and he made her come toward the soil creature. The soil creature said, this one, this time, bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh, to this one will be called woman, because from man, this one was taken. Now, the Hebrew brings out some word plays that you can't quite see. The word here for man, you know, we've been talking about Adam. For the first time in the Hebrew Bible now, we encounter a different word. It's ish. Now, he talks about the one that's, when he brings the one that Yehovah Elohim built before him, he said, this one this time will be called Isha, because from Ish, she was taken. You see the connection in the, right? All right, so the idea is that there's a connection there. There's a deep-seated connection. I did hear this, too. If you notice that the woman is built. You ever hear that? We use that phrase, man, that woman's built. So the idea, I don't know that they know that that's a Hebraic idea, but all women are built. So think about it. If somebody says, well, that person's not built any better than that, we're all women are built, right? That's what the Bible says. So there, you can tell people that. How about that? The idea, though, is that for the first time, we have a different word used for man. Now, I just wanted to bring this point out because I think it's important that we look through the Hebrew. You know, there are like four different words used in the early chapters of Genesis for that are always translated man. So when you look at the English in most translation, it just says man, that because the translator goes, ish. I mean, it's man. Just put man. You're like, but boss, it says it's a different Hebrew word. Psh, that's all the same. They'll never know. These people can't read Hebrew. So the idea is that you get the same word used, and what I'm trying to show you is that we need to go back. Now, why is it that Tabor uses soil creature? Because you think that sounds a little bit, it's different, you know? I mean, it sounds strange to our ears. It's because Adama is translated the ground or the soil. So Adam comes from the soil. So, you know, you have to think about what does that really mean? How do you get at the true meaning of that? How do you bring that out? Well, you could say a groundling comes from the ground, or an earthling comes from the earth. But see, then you start thinking planetary and all that, you know, earthling. But that's the idea.
All the other creatures came from the ground too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's true. That's true. But they're called something different. So they have different names for them. Behemah and all these other ideas. But good point. But the idea is that Adam and Adama are connected. So how do you make the connection in English and bring that across? Now, I want to move into a section of the story. We meet with a new character. And the character that we now meet is known as Nakash. And you heard me use that instead of serpent. See, in our English translations, most often it says in the serpent. And, you know, so we get this idea of a snake coiled around a tree and Eve is picking one of the beautiful apples and you know, I doubt it was an apple, but in fact, I think the text tells us what it is. But the idea is that they're taking part in the story that we have in our mind is often influenced by art. Our doctrines, our belief systems are often influenced by songs that are not doctrinally correct. See, we get these ideas that are not biblical in our head and they're hard to get out. What is it that approaches Adam? It's called Nakash. Now, it says in chapter 2, verse 25 that, let's look at it in this translation. It says, and the two of them were nude, the soil creature and his woman, and they were not ashamed. And then it goes in, there's no white space, and the Nakash was shrewd from every living thing of the field that Yehovah Elohim made. Did you hear that? Mm-hmm. Nude and shrewd. The two of them, the man and his woman, were nude, weren't ashamed, and the Nakash was shrewd. Now, why are those words? You hear the rhyme there? What Tabor is trying to bring out in the translation is that these come from the same root in Hebrew, arum. The man and the woman are arum, the root idea, bare, slick, nude. The serpent is, whatever they are, it says that the serpent is more arum. Yeah, or if you were going to translate it and try to keep that, some might say, the man, and I'll do this in my southern accent, the man and the woman were naked, and then you get to the snake and he's naked too, because it's the same Hebrew word, right?
Nakedness.
Yeah, nakedness. So the idea is that we want to show a connection between nude and shrewd. Or because it's the same Hebrew idea. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to talk a little bit about this. Now, what is it that the Nakash actually does? He introduces in the form of a question something quite interesting. Notice he says in verse chapter 3, verse 1, he said toward the woman, "Did Elohim say, you may not eat from any tree of the garden?" That's all he asked. Did Elohim say, indeed, you may not eat from any tree of the garden? Now, what's the correct answer to that? Look at verse 2. We're going to look at what she says. "And the woman said toward the Nakash, from the fruit of the trees of the garden we may eat, and from the fruit of the tree that is in the middle of the garden, Elohim said, you will not eat from it, and you will not touch it, lest you die." Now, here's a key point. I bring this up often, but it's very, very important. If you go back to chapter 2, verse 17, here's what Elohim said. "From the tree of the knowledge of good and bad, you will not eat from it, for on the day that you eat from it, dying, you will surely die." The command was, don't eat. No, you shall eat from that tree. That's it. Don't eat. Don't. Here's the command. I want to illustrate it like this. Or death. Because what we learn is that there is a consequence for sin. The soul that sins will die. All right? Now, here's what she says. I'm going to have to use a red marker because I want to add. She said, don't eat watch this or touch. It's interesting I used red letters for that. I didn't even mean to. But here's the idea. Here's don't eat. This is the command. This is what you don't eat. That's it. Don't eat or touch. Now I say this because I want you to get it. As far as this command goes, you could lick it, but you can't eat it. Now, I'm not saying we should push things that to that limit. My point is, don't add to. Don't add to, because when you add to, there's a problem. So in Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 2, Deuteronomy chapter 13, verse 1, it says, don't add to, don't take away from. Proverbs chapter 30, verse 6 says, if you add to the words of God, you're going to be found out to be a liar. So it's very important that we get this. Don't eat. That's always a command. Now, I want to make a point here because a lot of times women get a bad rap. People still blame women for causing the fall of man. It's all y'all's fault. Like, you know, y'all. You should. And, yeah, guys, that teaches. It says right there, you listen to the voice of your wife. That's why you're in trouble. And so, but a lot of theology gets this really whacked up. And so what I want to stress is that he was right there. He was right there. When this conversation takes place, she wasn't out picking something for dinner while he was at work. He's with her. It says in chapter 3, verse 6, and she, when she saw everything, she realized whatever, says she took it, she ate it, and she gave to her man who's right there with her, and he ate. So he didn't, like, get tricked or anything. I mean, he blamed it on her, but he was right there. So he's guilty, too. Now, another reason that I know they were right there together, besides the fact that it says she gave to her man that's with her, is that the snake uses plural verbs. So in the Hebrew, when it says, dying you will not, he's talking in plural. See, the Hebrew has a plural. Most English translations don't bring that out, so you miss that. All right. So now, I'm still working on this one. I'm not sure that maybe we can talk about it a little around the table in a few minutes, but something is hitting me in terms of I need to follow this detail through. You ever see something you don't quite know exactly what it is that you're studying out? But so I noticed something in the translation. Look at chapter 2, verse 9. It says, and Yehovah Elohim made sprout from the soil every tree desired for sight and good for an eatable thing. Did you? Now, here's what I want to do. I want to take that idea. I just want to use this idea to make a, to introduce something I'm looking at. Not that I have it figured out, but it's something really subtle here. All right? It says, let's see, verse 9. So this is what he's making, which is for food. And notice it's, let's just say, pleasant to see and good for food. All right? This is what God intended. All right. Pleasant, notice the order. Pleasant to see, good for food. Now, go to chapter 3, verse 6. Chapter 3, verse 6. This is leading up to the crime. And the woman saw that the tree was good for an eatable thing, and that it was longing to the eyes, and the tree was desirable for causing insight. Something switched here. All right, let me make the point. What she says in verse 6, it says, when she saw that the tree was good, let me do it this way. One, let's just use the same words, good for food, because I'm just making a point, I'm not quoting. Two, pleasant to see. Now you see, I'm telling you, I don't have quite a handle on this. But what I'm saying is that she's reversed. What God had intended was pleasant to see and good for food. When she looks at this temptation, she twists it. She twists it. So you see, we're going to talk about this more. But the order is reversed. I think there's a significance there. I think there's more to it than what I'm able to convey at this point. But what I'm my point is that there is this is what's forbidden. This is what she's looking at. She's looking at the forbidden. This is what's allowed. What's allowed is pleasant to see and good for food. What's forbidden was good for food and pleasant to see. In other words, the point that I want to make is be very careful, because sometimes that trick, sometimes that sin can be really, really close to what is allowed, what's permitted. But the forbidden might look like, might be pretty close, but something's not going to be right about it. That's all. It's a warning. So be on guard for clever and shrewd substitutes. Point taken, especially with matters of faith. Now, there are many insights in this particular portion. Adam, we learn Adam is in the image of the Creator. The Adam, both male and female, created to serve and guard the garden, to maintain the place of communion with the Creator was the intent. That was the whole purpose. Now, I want you to look with me to Exodus chapter 25. Exodus 25, verse 8 and 9. And I just want to read this one passage. Exodus chapter 25. Verse 8 and 9 says, and let them make for me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them, according to all that I show you, the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of its vessels, even so you shall make it. The idea of the garden, as we'll see as we work through the Torah, I believe begins to set forth a pattern. What has always been a desire of the Creator is to dwell in the midst of His people. To dwell in the midst of His people. The Torah itself gives us a way to begin to make that come to pass. That's the idea. Adam is tasked to govern over all. I'll bring that point back in our discussion. Life eternal is possible. We learn that from this particular Torah portion. There is a a tree of life. They could have eaten from the tree of life. That was not forbidden. Right? The only thing that was forbidden was to partake from the tree of the knowledge of good and bad. But they could have eaten from the tree of life. We're going to see in subsequent classes the immediate consequences. The directions, if you will, are meant to be guarded. All right? And by guarding, Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 2 says, don't add to or take away from. You should guard. Guard means don't add to or take away from. So by adding to and taking away from, you let down the guard. Right? That's what happens in the garden. She said, he said, don't eat or touch. She let down the guard. It doesn't take much. It can be subtle. It can be switching the order. It can be changing things up. We learned that body and spirit equal a living soul, a living life breather. The soul that sins, that one will die for his own sins. And the greatest, here's a point that comes to me. The greatest in Elohim's kingdom is truly a servant of all. Think about it. It's what we're wired to do. We're made to be a servant. Now, the ancient triennial cycle has prophetic portions assigned to these Torah portions. So in Isaiah chapter 51, we find the ancient prophet reading that is associated with this Torah portion that we've been covering today. So if you go to Isaiah 51, now we're not going to read the whole thing, but it goes from chapter 51, verse 6. Now it says, I will start with that verse, lift up your eyes to the heavens and look upon the earth beneath. There's this idea to look up and look down, look at the heavens and look at the earth. What we're talking about today is the birthings, the one from above and from the earth up, right? So this context, you see how the ancients would associate the readings from the prophets with the reading from the Torah portion. But I want you to go with me to verse 16 of chapter 51 in Isaiah. It says, and I have put my words in your mouth, and I have covered you in the shadow of my hand, that I may plant the heavens and lay the foundations of the earth and say to Zion, you are my people. Do what? Oh. Isaiah 51, 16 is the idea of taking the heavenly and planting it in the earth. What we are tasked to do in our job of servicing the soil is to plant heavenly principles in the earth. That's our task. We're farmers. We're sowers. We're to go out and sow seed. I could think of some things to say about that. But the planting of heavens begins when the words are in your mouth. You've not added to them. You've not taken from the word. See, that's what people are starving for. Deuteronomy chapter 30, remember verse 11 through 14? The word's very near to you. It's in your mouth and in your heart to do it. You don't have to wait for somebody to bring it from heaven. No one has to go across the sea. No one. Very near to you. It's in your mouth and in your heart to do it. Isaiah, one more passage. Isaiah 59. Isaiah 59, verse 21. By the way, when I was at the hospital, I was talking to this lady, and she was talking about her preacher. And she said, I had to tell the guy, you talk too long. And I said, how long has he talked? She said, about 30 minutes.
Oh, my God.
And I said, man. No, it was funny. All right, so Isaiah 59, verse 21. As for me, this is my covenant with them, says Jehovah. My spirit that is upon you and my words which I've put in your mouth shall not depart out of your mouth, nor out of the mouth of your seed, nor out of the mouth of your seed's seed, says Jehovah, from henceforth and forever. The covenant involves the spirit being in you and the words being in your mouth. We're talking about bringing forth a living life breather. The soul that sins will die. We have to live our life in such a way where we understand this covenant principle from Isaiah 59:21. We are, in all of our efforts, we should be working to bring about the kingdom of heaven on earth, to build it from the ground up. I want to close with the reading of Proverbs chapter 3. Now you'll see why. Proverbs chapter 3. Beginning in verse 1, "My son, forget not my Torah. Let your heart guard my commandments. For length of days and long life and peace shall they add to you. Let not loyal love and truth forsake you. Bind them about your neck. Write them upon the table of your heart, so you shall find grace and good understanding in the sight of God and man. Trust in Jehovah with all your heart, and don't lean upon your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He shall direct your paths. Be not wise in your own eyes. Fear Jehovah. Depart from evil. It shall be health to your navel, marrow to your bones. Honor Jehovah with your substance and with the first fruits of all your increase. So shall your barns be filled with plenty, and your vats shall burst with new wine. My son, don't despise the chastening of Jehovah, nor be weary of His correction. For Jehovah reproves him whom He loves, even as a father the son in whom he delights. Happy is the man who finds wisdom and the man who gets understanding. For the merchandise of it is better than the merchandise of silver. It's gained from fine gold. She is more precious than rubies, and all the things you can desire are not to be compared to her. Length of days are in her right hand, and in her left hand are riches and honor. Her ways are ways of pleasantness, and all her paths are peace. She is a tree of life to those who lay hold on her, and happy are those who hold her fast. Jehovah, by wisdom, founded the earth. By understanding, He established the heavens." Goes on. I wanted to capture that last part because it ties in the creation. The images in some of these texts that occur later in the Bible, in the Psalms and the Proverbs and the prophets, are alluding to and looking back to that creation. In Proverbs 3, it begins with, you have to incorporate, internalize the Torah, put it in your heart. The idea is that you would take these things in. It's greater than any treasure you can imagine. It's the great, and look, don't lean to your own understanding, but trust in these things. That's what the point is. It says basically that everything that we're talking about, the Torah, represents in a way a tree of life. In next week's class, we begin to get to that place where exile is a consequence of the departure that took place in this reading. You have to stay tuned to hear that story next week. We just want to take these one at a time.